Counsel ready?
Ready, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
May it please the court. Mr. Cully, good morning. I'd like to state at the outset that it's a real honor and a privilege for me to be here and discuss these issues with you today. I think it's important to sort of frame the procedural posture of this case, and I'll try to take a minute or so to do that. This matter came before the Industrial Accident Board on what we call an original petition for compensation due, as distinguished from a petition for additional compensation due. Trial was set for December the 30th, 2005. The case settled the day before on December the 29th. The terms of the settlement included an acknowledgement that an attorney's fee was due. This is a little different than General Motors versus Alcaraz, slightly different. I think it's not a very important distinction, but it is one, and I'll come back to it in a little while. Because in Alcaraz, the employer's position was this settlement offer does not contain any provision for attorney's fees. This one did, although the sum could not be pinned down, as it were. So the amount of the fee went unresolved for a while, ultimately came before the board on March the 29th of 06 under an Alcaraz hearing, where the sole issue was, what is a reasonable attorney's fee? That's why the record is so terse and so small, because it was a very, very simple and limited issue that the board had to consider. The board concluded that a $400 fee was a reasonable fee, and the Superior Court affirmed that.
The $400 was roughly 30%. It was basically a mechanical multiplication of 30% times the dollar number, amount of the settlement?
Precisely.
And your argument is that $1,200 was not was too low a base, that there were non-monetary benefits that should have been included in computing the attorney's fee.
That's precise.
That's in essence what you're arguing.
Absolutely. There's a threshold question. It has to be reasonable, of course.
Right.
And I would argue.
And the first question is, well, what are the non-monetary benefits? And your answer to that was there was a determination of compensability.
Yes.
And that has dollar value. But how, if at all, do you reduce that benefit to a dollar value?
I don't think you can. So I think that takes you to the other portion of the fee statute, you know, that is to say that subject to the 2001 amendment, the 10 times the average weekly wage limitation.
What is that amount as of the time of this case?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I don't know exactly, but it's approximately $7,000.
And your fee application was for how much?
Simply was for a reasonable fee based upon the Cox factors, including the result obtained on behalf of the claimant in this case, which is a specific Cox factor that I would argue was really ignored by the IAB and the Superior Court, for that matter, because they zeroed in solely on the first part of the matrix, that is to say, a 30% of a liquidated amount.
So while 400 is wrong, you did not come up with a number that you contend is right. Did you present the board with award us what we think is right under Cox?
Not a specific amount. I submitted a fee affidavit, which is required by the IAB rule, and typically you leave it to their discretion to determine what that is. I did argue below that the non-monetary features of a finding of compensability were critically important and should be considered in terms of establishing a reasonable fee in this case.
Let me focus on that for a moment. Won't a finding of compensability always go hand in hand with a determination that the claimant is entitled to an award, at least if it's an original petition?
It will. That's true.
So what you're saying is that although this is a non-monetary benefit that goes with every decision, every favorable decision, it should be an added factor in determining a fee award?
Absolutely.
Is there any history for that?
Well, Alcaraz is really right on point. It's a fascinating case. It's very, very similar to this case. There was a settlement within 30 days. Of course, that offer did not include attorney's fees. And I can almost picture the colloquy between the two lawyers. Look, we'll pay the $152 in medical expenses and acknowledge this as a compensable injury, but we're not going to pay you an attorney's fee. And in State v. Drews, the matter wound up on the merits, all the issues before the board. Here, the claimant's attorney was pretty creative and said, fine, I accept your offer in terms of compensability and the payment of the $152 in medical expenses, but I'll see you at the board on a legal hearing in terms of whether or not you owe a fee. I'm going to extract a fee out of you, as it were. And, of course, in that case, the board awarded a $250 attorney's fee. The employer appealed, and the argument of the employer should resonate with you. Number one, the argument was, this is not an award. The claimant is not entitled to a fee, notwithstanding the late hour when the case settled. And secondly, if the claimant is entitled to a fee, it can only be 30% of the $152 in medical expenses that we are picking up as part of this claim. This claimant did not miss any time from work. And the Superior Court rejected that argument, as did the Industrial Accident Board, incidentally, ruling both of them that the $250 fee award in that case was for a finding of compensability. That's precisely the argument that I made below that was rejected. So what we have is...
Well, does the legislative scheme contemplate that the Industrial Accident Board, in terms of an award, can only award so much, no matter what a reasonable fee might be? Whereas if the matter were on appeal and successfully prosecuted by the claimant, there's no cap as long as the fee is reasonable, either in the Superior Court or the Supreme Court. So do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
So what is the legislative purpose in imposing a cap on the Industrial Accident Board? Is it to keep matters simple and straightforward so they are expedited through a system quickly and the compensation pie is not drained by attorney's fees, or what? What is their purpose in imposing a cap?
That's really a penetrating question. I think you're absolutely correct that that's part of it. I think another part, though, is let's say a very, very serious injury case, very large compensable benefits, you know, a high wage earner, a colossal permanency claim, for example. I think the concern is not to, have the tail wagging the dog, where the critical issue in the case becomes, well, how much is the attorney going to be awarded, vis-a-vis what's an appropriate award of the underlying compensation benefits. I think it's just to sort of, chill everyone in terms of, what the real issues are in the case, to focus on the compensable benefits and not so much the attorney's fees. And, of course, it's in the legislature, there are compromises. I wasn't around in 1966, of course, when the $2,250 cap was set, amended in 2001. It's my understanding it was smaller than that. It may have been $1,000 before it was $2,250. I'm not really clear on how that evolved. But, of course, it was $2,250 from 1966 to 2001.
So would the legislature, if they contemplated for whatever their reason that you speculated upon, as I have, that there is a cap, that intent would apply both to a case that proceeded through a hearing and a case that doesn't, right? Assuming they can award attorney's fees when there is not an award.
Yes.
So is your argument just simply that the wrong cap was applied here?
That's exactly right, because if you simply look at the $1,200 in total disability benefits that were awarded, you can't just look at that sort of myopically especially in terms of an original petition for compensation due. You have to look, and even this court has confirmed that the non-monetary benefits are very real, and it's troubling in this case when both the IAB and the Superior Court are calling those other benefits entirely speculative. They're not speculative.
Well, if the case had gone to hearing and they had been an award of $1,200, the maximum amount they could have awarded as attorney's fees would have been $400?
I don't think so. I believe that, you know, the same argument would have been advanced by me regardless of the 11th hour settlement versus an actual trial on the merits.
And let's proceed from there, because I'm having problems with how your argument works. Whether the case had gone to a hearing, as Justice Ritchie asked, or proceeded in the way it actually did proceed, your argument is that we're into Section 23.2010B, correct? It's subsection B that we're talking about.
If the matter had gone to a hearing, well, if there had been a settlement offer and the matter had gone to a hearing, in other words, if I had pressed the matter forward, you know, your offer is too low, I'll take my chances with the board, then the employer introduces the settlement offer in a sealed envelope, and the board can consider, you know, that in terms of an award on the merits. That did not happen here because, frankly, what was pending before the board was a $1,200 wage claim and medical expenses.
Let me get back to my question. Subsection B authorizes 30% of the award, and this is the language that you, I thought you were relying on when you answered an earlier question of mine, 10 times the average weekly wage in Delaware. Right?
Yes.
And your argument is that the latter formula should apply?
To this case.
And that would have been how much? We don't know.
We don't know. Something that would have taken into account the significance of the compensability finding, the fact that you know,
all right,
I had worked more than 13 hours to bring the case to that point.
But it would have been a larger amount than $400.
Indeed.
But the statute, subsection B, goes on to say that, you know, of those two options, the court has to award, or what is awardable in terms of a fee is whichever is smaller. So under subsection B, you're still down to the 30%, right?
I agree.
So where are we, you know, even in terms of your argument?
Well, Your Honor, this court has addressed exactly that in other contexts. For example, in State v. Drews, which I mentioned earlier, that was a case where...
Without telling me what happened in other cases, just answer the question, and then feel free to talk about the precedent. But under the statute that you're relying on, there's still a mandate, if I read the language correctly, to award the lower amount. And that would be $400 in this case.
If you take that view of the statute that it requires 30% of a liquidated amount, I agree with you. But the case law suggests that it's not that simple when there are other, you know, unliquidated, if you will, non-monetary benefits involved. You can't just zero in on the monetary part and make a reasonable fee solely on that basis. Well, that's what the cases say.
And that gets us back to where we started, or at least where I started with my first question, which was, how do you reduce the non-monetary benefit to a dollar value in order to apply the 30%? Your response was you can't, and so we drop back to the other alternative, which is 10 times the average weekly wage.
Up to that.
The problem with that is that the statute goes on to say that as between the two, you pick the lower number. So I don't know where we are. I don't know how this argument gets you to where you want to go.
Yeah, that's a very legitimate, certainly, observation. But if you look at what the cases say in terms of the significance of non-monetary benefits, it does take you to a different place. Just as an example.
let me interrupt. If I understand where your argument goes, it is as follows. The statute applies, even though this was a settlement, because you're operating under the same framework as if you had gone to a hearing. Okay, so that's part A. The statute applies. The statute says you either get 30% of the amount of your award or 10 times the average weekly wage, whichever is smaller. And I think we all agree that the 30% is going to be the smaller number in this case.
Right? True.
Okay. So then we're left with it's 30% of what? So we have $1,200 is a liquidated amount, but you're saying it should be 30% of $1,200 plus some X. And you're saying, if I understand correctly, that that X is an unknown. You're not putting a dollar value on that. You're not saying that the determination of compensability and the other non-monetary benefits are worth $400, they're worth $800, they're worth $5,000. You're not putting any dollar amount on it, right?
Correct.
And what you're saying is that the board and ultimately the courts should just pick a number that seems appropriate for those non-monetary benefits and then do 30% of whatever the combined figure comes to.
Well, you're not stuck with the 30% once you go to the other part of the statute. And many, many cases
What other part of the statute?
Well, the statute that says you could award up to 10 times the average weekly wage. That may be, consider an example, and this is a prominent one.
Wait a second. You still have to choose whichever is the smaller number, right?
Right.
Okay, so if 10 times the average wage is, for purposes of discussion, $7,000, okay, the award here is $1,200, 30% of that is $400. If we add, we'd have to add another $20,000 or something to make the 30% number get to be larger than the alternative, right?
True. But in many situations, you have petitions to terminate where the employer attempts to cut off the wage benefit of the claimant. And let's say that's either unsuccessful or simply withdrawn at some point while the petition is pending. The IEB, the Superior Court, this court has never gotten into the 30% matrix in that context and said, how do we figure out, 30% of what? Conkeel is a Huffman case, but it's an interesting case because the employer unilaterally said, look, every week that your client, congratulations, we've lost our petition to terminate. Every week that we pay your client a benefit, we will send you a separate check of $79 per week to help, compensate you for the fee that was awarded in that case, which simply said 30% of the award or the full amount, $7,300, which was 10 times the average weekly wage at that time. And when that came before the Superior Court in a Huffman context, the Superior Court said that's nonsense. Who said you could do that? Pay the $7,300 and be done with it. So that's an example of where you can really get caught up in the 30% part. You have to look at this statute in its entirety, and I would just sum up by saying this. It has to be a reasonable award. It wasn't reasonable in this case for what was achieved, for the result obtained, a Cox factor.
Thank you.
Doesn't get you there.
You're into your rebuttal time.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Dave Cully, and I represent the appellee Walmart Stores Incorporated in this appeal. I'd like to start with the reasonableness issue, since that is where most of the questioning and the focus occurred during Mr. Eliason's time. And I think the court's questions have pretty much framed my argument in terms of, one, you have to, assuming the statute applies, and that's a big assumption, obviously, we're here for today, but assuming the statute applies, the only context in which the statute can apply in this case is under subsection A. And subsection A has that statutory language in it that the court has referenced, and it does have a statutory cap in terms of the amount of fee that can be awarded for a case that results in an award. Now, again, we can argue about what an award means, but in the context of this case, the Pugh case, it is clear, I would submit, on this record, that the award was $1,200 in temporary total disability benefits.
What about the medical expenses?
Well, interestingly, the award could have been more in this case, but because of some procedural issue that occurred before the matter got to settlement, the board determined that those medical bills, and the Superior Court agreed with that and affirmed that, determined that the medical bills had not been properly submitted for consideration. So they weren't in the mix. They weren't part of the potential award bucket, if you will, that would have been there for the award of attorney's fee.
Were they part of the settlement?
It's difficult to answer that in part because I was not counsel of record.
Isn't there
for Walmart at
that
time
that memorialized what this agreement was?
The file that I got and the portion of the appendix does not reflect, at least that I've seen, an indication as to exactly what was agreed to. But let's say for the sake of this question and this argument that the medical bills were part and parcel of the settlement that occurred.
You know what their amount was?
I do not know. If this case had gone to a hearing, and if they had not been properly submitted according to the board's procedural rules, which is essentially what the court or the board determined in this case, without a hearing occurring, they would not have been considered by the board, and they would not have been part of that bucket of money on which a fee could be based. So if you're applying the statutory language and you're applying it faithfully, as we've been talking about this morning, it seems to me that you have to apply the 30% to the quote-unquote award as that is defined. And that's what the board did in this case, and that's exactly what the court, the Superior Court affirmed. Now, we cited in our answering brief three cases. They're not directly on point, but they are three cases in which the issue of the reasonableness of an award under subsection A, meaning the 30% analysis, was adopted by or approved. And in the case of the Cardos case, General Motors versus Cardos, that was a Supreme Court decision. Superior Court, Judge Lee, in two cases at the Superior Court level, adopting that case or using that case, indicated that the Supreme Court, this court, had expressly sanctioned the use of a 30% analysis in a case like this, where all you have essentially is a monetary benefit on which to assess the attorney's fee. Now, I did want to so there are three cases that I would suggest do approve exactly what we've been arguing and what the court, I think, has suggested in terms of the application of the statutory language. I'd like to address, though, the non-monetary benefits because there were a lot of questions about that, and I think fair questions. The non-monetary benefits were defined by the claimant at page 9 of her initial reply brief as compensability, establishment of jurisdiction of the board over the case, and the extension, if you will, of the statute of limitations to the 5-year statute of limitations as opposed to the 2-year statute of limitations. All legitimate interests, but all we would submit were subsumed into the compensability issue itself. I think Justice Berger asked the question, well, isn't the issue of compensability in a case like this where the award involves a monetary award of benefits essentially caught up or subsumed into that issue? And I would submit to you that it is. There's really no way under the statute that I can conceive of that the board can on a day-to-day basis put a value on establishment of jurisdiction and extension of a statute of limitations and acceptance of compensability in order to apply the 30% language. The only other benefits that the claimant achieved or argues, contends that she achieved by this settlement was the potential for the receipt of future benefits, particularly permanency and disfigurement. That is the issue on which the board and the Superior Court both felt was entirely too speculative. It may be that Ms. Pugh will, at some time in the future, receive a permanency assessment from a medical doctor, and it may be that she will petition for those benefits. But it is entirely unknown and unquantifiable at the time this decision was made by the board or even today as to whether that's going to occur. And there is simply no way, no practical way that I can think of, that the board could value that, put a number on that, in order to apply the statutory language.
And if that were to come to pass, wouldn't the claimant be entitled to attorney's fees at that point?
No question about it, and we argued that in our brief. At that point in time, the statute applies. If there is a hearing and an award based upon the permanency benefits, there will be an award of an attorney's fee.
It's at least arguable that in the small numbers cases, that may be the area where a claimant needs an attorney the most, because an employer could turn their back and say it's just not worth it for you to pursue it. And so an attorney comes in to assist the claimant and achieves $150 benefit. Is it you contend that it was the legislature's intent that that circumstance, no matter how much reasonable time was put in by the attorney, is capped at 30% of $150?
I think if that's all that's at issue, if there is two medical bills that are at issue and have to be tried, I can't read the statutory language the way that it's written. And keep in mind that the legislature has had the benefit of this case law when it enacted this statute, had the benefit of this case law, and could have written something different and chose not to. So my position is that it intentionally wrote it this way. Are there going to be some cases along the way that, as a practical matter, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense? That may be one of them. Does that mean that we need counsel who will take that case on, realizing that there may be a fee achieved? Yes, but there may be, in fact, by the establishment of compensability, additional benefits and future benefits down the road for which attorney's fees could be collected.
Well, if I understood opposing counsel correctly, an award of $250 was made in, I think, the Alvarez case, simply for a finding of compensability. How does that square with what you're saying?
Well, I think if the only issue before the board is compensability, and there is no benefit on which there is a monetary amount, then I think the board has to exercise its discretion and determine what the value of that compensability is, I suppose. I don't know any other way of applying the statute. I think some of the difficulty we're dealing with here is that the statute is written the way it's written, and it's unfortunately, I think, fairly straightforward, although, again, the General Assembly could have written it differently. It had this history, it knew this history, and it could have written it differently. If the only issue is compensability, then I suppose the board could put a value on it and then award 30% of that value or 10 times the average weekly wage, again, the magic language being whichever is less, whichever is the smaller.
And if that's the case, then presumably the board could have done that here too. Presumably.
It could have, but in this case there was a monetary benefit.
True, but is there some rule anywhere that says that where there's a monetary benefit, the board is precluded from attempting to monetize the non-monetary benefit?
I don't believe there is, and therein is there's some tension in the language of the statute, clearly.
Well, is it correct then that, Mr. Cully, that your argument is that although perhaps the board could have monetized non-monetary benefit, which in this case was the determination of compensability, it wasn't required to do it, and it didn't abuse its discretion?
It was not required to do it. It did not abuse its discretion. And I would submit that the board, as a matter of fact, and I think the court appreciates this, has a great deal of experience in this area, and they have a lot of institutional experience that's very important. They probably decide an attorney's fee issue at least once a week, I am guessing, in the state, if not more often. And I think some deference needs to be given to that. I think in fairness to the board, who has to decide these matters every day, they strive, I would submit, for some consistency. And they would, I think, try to address the odd case that Justice Ridgely posed. But ultimately, the board is charged with applying the statute, assuming the statute applies in this case, applying the statute and looking at the Cox factors, which they are required to do as well. The board determined in this case that although there was an issue of compensability, although there is an argument for extension of statute of limitation, these other non-monetary benefits, the board applied the Cox factors and said the most important factor here, in our view, the primary factor, is the result obtained, the amount involved and the result obtained. The board, I would submit, although the claimant argues otherwise, thoroughly considered all of the Cox factors but found that one, the amount involved and the result obtained, to be the most important one and exercised its discretion in that regard.
Go ahead.
But let's assume momentarily that the statute doesn't apply or did not apply. What in those circumstances is the board to do when confronted with a fee application?
Well, that gets into the threshold question that the court's questions that resulted in the supplemental briefing.
It does.
I believe it does. This is one of those cases where it falls between. This is a case that falls between, and there are many of them. These settlements happen all the time, that falls between subsection A and subsection B. This was not a situation where a settlement offer was made more than 30 days before the hearing, and if the employer did better at the hearing, there's no fee awarded. Nor is it a case, we have argued, in looking upon the case law and the statutory language, where there was an award. So it's our position that this is actually one of those cases that falls between the two subsections.
It falls between. Now what?
Well, it's our position, as argued in our brief, that if subsection A does not apply, and we don't have to worry about subsection B here because it didn't happen. If subsection A does not apply, then there is no authority that the board has to award an attorney's fee. If subsection A does not apply.
So Alcaraz was wrongly decided?
We believe so. Alcaraz was a Superior Court decision. In that case, Judge Gebelein determined, and he cited the Lattice case, but he determined that essentially no discussion about the statute. Well, I mean, there was a discussion about the statute, but not the language of the statute we've been wrestling with today. But he said that the intent of the legislature was, in circumstances like this, to give the board authority, or the board has authority, to award an attorney's fee. And I would submit that if this court were determined that there was no award in this case, and we have argued in our brief that an award traditionally had meant a hearing with presentation of evidence before the board. Okay, this court kind of stepped back from that a little bit in the Drews case and the Lattice case. In Drews, claimant went right up to the hearing, day before the hearing, much like this. The employer conceded everything, conceded entire liability. This court said, that's the equivalent of an award. If they had gone to the hearing the next day, that's what the claimant would have gotten. In the Lattice case, petition to terminate is filed. Claimant has to get an attorney. Employer withdraws the petition, conceding entire liability. This is not a settlement situation where there's contested claims and there's a settlement of less than the whole claimed. In that situation, that's the equivalent of an award. That is not the case we have here today. So the case we have here today, I would submit, if it's not an award under A, it falls between the two subsections, and we would submit the board has no authority aside from the statute.
Right, and your position, however, presupposes or assumes that Section 2320 is the grant, the only grant of authority.
It does assume that. We've argued that we found no other. And I don't think claimant has argued that there is any other statutory authority given to the board in this area.
Well, the Section 2320 could be read that way, but it also could be read as a set of directions to the board as to how to calculate a fee under some circumstances. Or I say it differently, the source of the power to grant a fee is residual, and found in the statute, even though not explicitly, and 2320 is simply a set of directions that applies in some circumstances, but maybe in not all.
I've thought about that, but my position, and I would submit to the court, that would be this court taking the statute as it exists beyond what is written and intended. And I hearken back to this fact. Maybe it was an oversight. I don't know. But when this attorney's fee statute was enacted yet again, there was a predecessor statute. When it was enacted yet again in 2001, I believe it was, the legislature had the history of this issue and the case law. I think it can be presumed from that the General Assembly was comfortable with this court's definition of what an award is. And the definition of an award has been consistently held by this court to exclude a voluntary agreement. There's a voluntary agreement short of a hearing where contested matters are resolved short of the whole. If the legislature had wanted an attorney's fee to be awarded in that situation, in those situations, it could simply have said so when it wrote the statute, and it didn't.
Can we turn back for a moment to the amount of the award? Because notwithstanding what you've just been discussing, if I understand correctly, it's your position that this is governed by 2320.10a, right?
Well, to be consistent with our argument in our brief, and I'll drop back. Historically, I was not the attorney of record below, so I wasn't the author of the arguments below. I agree that the parties assumed, and the board, frankly, assumed, they had the authority to award an attorney's fee under 2320A in this 2320.10A.
Okay. What I want to try and deal with is, if I understand the practice, which is an important part of, mm-hmm. of what we're dealing with here, as well as what case law there is, it would appear that what happens is when you have a reasonably large, more than a couple of $100 as the amount awarded, then they use their 30% formula and come up with a number, easy. And that on a case where there's either no monetary award, which is unusual but has happened, or is really small to the point that a figure based on 30% of it would be truly de minimis, then the board goes ahead and awards some number that they consider reasonable, like $250 or $300 or something, still very small, but many times what would have been awarded if you used the 30% formula, right?
If we conclude that subsection A applies, and it's our position, having been focused on that issue by the court with its supplemental questions, it in the context of a voluntary agreement like this, it does not.
Okay. What I'm trying to deal with, though, is if we're going to write a decision and hopefully give some guidance both to the practitioners and the board,
right,
how do we deal with the very small monetary award situation? Do we say it is, implicit here that, or inherent in the board's authority that it can give some dollar value to other factors when the monetary award is particularly small? Is that kind of the rule that we should be announcing?
The court can interpret the statute. And I think the court can interpret the statute consistent with the intent. I don't think it's inconsistent with the language of the statute to suggest, for this court to suggest, that there are non-monetary benefits that can be valued by the board in the appropriate case, this not being one of them, in the appropriate case, and a fee awarded under subsection A.
Thank you.
I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court.
If I may, I'd like to start with exactly the same question for you. If you were writing the decision and how would you explain the situations under which an award could be based upon other than or in addition to the dollar amount awarded?
What you do is you award a reasonable fee, and you're not stuck with the 30% matrix, and you should do what's done in petitions to terminate, where the petition is either withdrawn or the employer loses. You look at the time spent, you look at the Cox factors, you look at the results obtained, and don't fool around with trying to measure some future income stream, and simply make a reasonable fee award that takes into account the other cap, if you will, that is 10 times the average weekly wage in Delaware. And if I could just very quickly say, the legislature is aware, when they amend the statute in 01, what awards are. And they've embraced what awards are, and I think that's another way to look at the amendment from 2001. Thank you.
Let me just ask one question. On the petitions to terminate, where the petition's withdrawn or the employer loses, there are board decisions that basically place a value on what?
What they do is they simply look at the fee affidavit that should address all 10 of the Cox factors and make a reasonable award, you know, perhaps tied to some reasonable hourly rate, but they do not apply 30% to anything. They simply say, this lawyer spent 17 hours defending this successfully. Let's go through the Cox factors. Let's come up with a reasonable fee, subject, of course, to the other cap, if you will, in the statute.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement. Take a recess.